was closest to the door, but then she learned she'd been right when she imagined the others would have to crawl across the other beds in order to get out of the room. In the middle of the night, she was woken by a knee near her face. A foot flicked across her belly, the general rocking and creaking her cot made with the weight of another body trying to pass. There was a Flushing indoor lavatory down the hall from their rooms, but long before Mary's arrival, someone had made the decision that the hallway privy encouraged too much movement in the middle of the night, and so a chamber pot was set up in the corner of the bedroom farthest from the door. If she wasn't woken by someone traveling on top of her, she woke to the sound of someone letting go a stream of urine into a ceramic pot, followed by the sound of four other women tossing violently in their sleep to shut out the noise. She had to find something else. She thought about her old building, about Fran and Joan. Fran's place was full up with her own family, and Joan, they'd make room for her, she knew. They would sympathize. But it was their sympathy that stopped her. They had each warned her about Alfred in their different ways, Joan quietly and Fran less so, but she had not listened. And now here she was, just a few years later, living in a boarding house while Alfred made a new family with a new woman. No, she wouldn't be able to stomach it. The inevitable human need, they'd have to point out that they'd been right and she was wrong. Instead, she asked Lee if he knew of anyone looking for a boarder. She told him she'd even live with a Chinese. She tried to ask the Lithuanians, but they didn't understand her. She stopped in at all the churches, Catholic or not, between the laundry and Mrs. Post's, to read the bulletin boards. She scoured the ads in the paper. She quietly suggested to two of the other women at Mrs. Post's that they strike out together and find a place to themselves, but neither of them was interested, or else they didn't believe it would be possible for three women to rent rooms together without a man to sign for them. Then, very early, one Tuesday morning, she heard her name being called. "Mary!" a woman's voice chased her from across the street. "Mary Mallon!" She turned and saw Joan Graves hold out her hand to stop traffic as she rushed across the street to Mary's side. "I can't believe it," Joan said and threw her arms around Mary. "Joan," Mary said simply and let herself be hugged. She was happy to see Joan. Silly Joan, talented Joan, who could sew more surely than anyone Mary had ever known.
"I'd heard there was a hearing, but I thought they'd taken you back to the island."
"Oh, you heard all about it, I'm sure."
"Well, it was in the papers. We followed it, Fran and I did. But you're here, and look at you. I thought you were sick. Have you been sick? What are you doing now? Where are you living? Why didn't you come see us right away?"
"I was planning to, but..."
"And what about Alfred? Have you seen him? He told Franz Robert that he did the Oppenheimer cure."
Mary didn't remember Joan being so aggressive. She didn't remember her as a piler of questions, and she was absolutely certain that the old Joan would have never brought up the cure, which was a roundabout way of bringing up the problem, and the drink, and the late nights, and Mr. Hallinan's shouts up the stairs. The Joan Mary knew might have brought it up privately with such subtlety that Mary wouldn't know what she was talking about right away. Not out on the street. Not first thing after seeing her after so long.
"Where did you see Alfred?"
she might as well ask, rather than be distracted by wondering all day long.
"In the building. He does odd jobs for Mr. Driscoll now and again after he finishes up at the stable."
"You haven't seen him?"
"No."
"I'm sorry, Mary. I heard about his new place. I don't know why I asked that." Mary wanted to ask several questions at once. Did he seem happy? What did they talk about? But she didn't ask anything. No, she was not interested. She would not beg for information. She would not ask for Joan's husband and all of their neighbors, just so that at the end of that long list she could ask discreetly about Alfred. She wouldn't do it.
"I'm late, Joan. It was great seeing you."
"But you haven't seen me. Mary, you must come by. Will you come for supper one night? On Sunday? When were you released?" Mary was already sidestepping toward the laundry, which she could see was open and accepting customers. Let them fire her, she thought. Let them try. She'd march straight up to Ladero's office and ask him for the money from his wallet. She'd wait in the street outside Soper's office and mug him as he made his way home.
"I'm not sure I can, Joan. I'll let you know."
"Yes, let me know. If not this Sunday, then next Sunday."
"I'll let you know."
Mary had turned now, was walking away.
"Oh, and Mary!" Joan called after her. "Mary, I almost forgot!"
Mary steeled herself. She'd met Alfred's Liza. She'd met precious Samuel. Mary wanted to take her scarf and stuff it in Joan's mouth. We have a baby girl now. She's 11 months. You have to see her. She's the sweetest thing, and... Mary stopped. You had a baby? You're kidding me! I'm not kidding, Joan laughed. You are right. Sometimes it does take a long time. Will you come by, Mary, to meet her? I can't believe it. Mary looked around as if the baby might be hiding in an alley, peeking out at them. Joan laughed. Fran is minding her. She lets me get out by myself for an hour. It was Mary's turn to laugh. Fran? I thought she said she was done with babies once she got her last one in school. She once told me she'd push Robert straight out the window if he said he wanted to have another. You know Fran. She was the first one cooing into the bassinet when she was born. What's her name?
Dorothy Alice.
Even saying the child's name, Mary saw, cast a glow of joy on Joan's face. All the impatience Mary felt just a few minutes previous was gone, and now she hugged her friend, told her that she was happy for her. Joan would be a good mother, and if the child had half the heart Joan had, she'd be a kind person. For the first time since leaving North Brother, Mary forgot why she hadn't seen her friends in so long, and wanted to go straight over to the old building to tease Fran. Joan would make a pot of coffee, and the three of them would gab away the morning. Who cared about Alfred? Not her. If she passed him in the hall, she wouldn't even turn to look at him. As the moment began to pass, Joan frowned. And you're not sick, right, Mary? You don't look sick. What they said about you and those people you cooked for? It's not true, is it? That's why they let you out? Mary sighed. They only said it was ever the people I cooked for who got sick.
And that wasn't true?
Well, a few got sick. A handful, really, out of how many I've cooked for. But it was a coincidence. It was a... Well, it wasn't fair, anyway. There's a dairyman upstate. I knew it. I said to myself, our Mary has no disease. The way you used to work so hard and run up and down those stairs. So you'll come and meet the baby, won't you? And as Mary heard herself promise that she would, she knew it was true. She wanted to see Joan's baby. She wanted to see Fran. Even Patricia Tiernan would be a familiar face. And what had she craved those 3 years on North Brother but a familiar face? What had she wanted most but to talk to someone who knew things about her that had nothing to do with Soper or typhoid or even cooking? And they were her friends. They would understand that she didn't want to talk about Alfred, that there was nothing to say. Never in all the years they'd known one another did either Joan or Fran say a word about their not being married. Only concerns about his health and how hard she worked, and if, perhaps, she didn't sometimes wish she had a man who took care of her and not the other way around. But there hadn't been judgment, not really. And she had to hope there would be no judgment now, either, after the humiliation of his leaving her, marrying someone else.
15.
She worked. After 2 months at the laundry, Lee told her they'd been worried about taking her on as a favor, but that she was as fine a worker as any Chinese, as any person Lee had ever known. He told her that Chu was also very pleased. The Lithuanian women acknowledged her more often, nodding and giving her brief smiles before turning back to their stew of cottons and wools. In the window of the corner grocer, she found an ad for a woman boarder. The building was on 31st Street and 2nd Avenue, and she decided not to care that it was so close to the old building. But when she went over there, she saw that it was little better than Mrs. Post's. There were cots everywhere, and a pair of exhausted-looking women sitting at a table without talking to each other while she got the 10-second tour and a rundown of the rules. There had to be something better, but it was impossible to really look, with only half a day off every week and the long hours of the weekdays. She pursued another ad she'd seen in the newspaper, but when she got there, nothing seemed right. The large living area, the high ceilings, the separate kitchen. The man, who emerged quietly from one of the 3 bedrooms and held a hushed discussion in the corner with the widow who'd answered the door at Mary's knock. The man skulked by Mary and ran down the stairs of the building without saying goodbye or good day to anyone, not even the women lounging on the silk sofa like cats stretched out in the sun. Mary realized where she was, just as the young widow came over to her and asked her to take down her hair, reaching, as she said it, for Mary's pins. Mary held tight to the banister as she made her way back down to the street. She searched for a month, 6 weeks, 2 months. The weather grew warmer, the rooms at Mrs. Post's closer. The nightly foot to the face or the belly was growing familiar, and that worried Mary Moore. She refused to grow accustomed to living that way. There had to be people who were honest and needed someone like Mary to help. June passed. July. 2 of the women at Mrs. Post's left, and with the breathing space those 2 empty cots offered, Mary decided to wait a few weeks, to spend her Sunday afternoons doing something else for a change, walking in the park, taking herself out for a sandwich. A few weeks turned into the entire summer. Then, at the end of September, as she was walking north along 3rd Avenue near 36th Street, she ran into Mrs. Borriello and one of her sons at the produce cart that traveled around the neighborhood. "I remember you," the son said before anyone had said hello. "Mama," he turned. "She used to live in the building, wasn't she?" Mrs. Borriello hushed the boy by touching him lightly on the shoulder. She spoke in Italian. "She says hello. How are you doing?" the boy said. "She said she's glad to see you." "I'm happy to see you," Mrs. Borriello said in accented English. Mary smiled at Mrs. Borriello, who had aged since Mary saw her last. "How are you?" she asked the boy. Carmine, she recalled, and the youngest one was Anthony. She calculated the oldest brother to be dead 4 years now. How well she remembered that afternoon, the hush that fell over the building when the news went up and down that the boy, sent by his mother to gather wood by the bulkhead on 28th Street, had been reaching for a piece of driftwood when he slipped into the river and was swept away. It came out later that Carmine, who'd gone along with his older brother, had run along the riverbank looking for help and came to a group of laborers having a breakup on the pier. "Please," he begged them, "my brother." But all they did was look where the boy was pointing, and after a minute, as they all watched the boy drift farther away, and as they took their lunches from their pockets, one of the men offered the boy half a sandwich for strength before he went home to tell his mother. Mary wondered now if they ever fished the boy's body from the river. "How is Anthony?" Mary asked. "He's doing good." The boy looked at Mary, then down at his hands, and then back at Mary. She wanted to touch his face. "Hey, did you hear about my father? That he died?" "No," Mary said. She put her hand on Mrs. Borriello's arm. "I'm sorry to hear about your husband." "How? He was a young man." Mrs. Borriello pulled her scarf tighter around her hair. "A freak thing," the boy said. "He was down framing a new building on Broadway and Broome, and they said he had the harness on to do a little welding job up on the beam, and then a strong wind came and he lost his footing and the harness broke, and he fell." It was the 4th-story floor beam. How many times had the boy heard the story, Mary wondered, to be able to tell it so matter-of-factly? What could he understand about beams and framing and the building of buildings? He was probably about 10 years old now, but he seemed to Mary both older and younger. Older with his swagger and his way of speaking for his mama, but younger when she examined his soft face, his long eyelashes. The way, underneath everything he said, he seemed to look at each of the women and ask, "Did I say it right? Is that really what happened to my papa? Just a beam and a broken harness and a gust of wind? And before that, my brother? Is it really possible that he was there beside me one moment and swept away the next? That there was nothing tying him more closely to his life or my papa to his?" "Your poor mother," Mary said in a whisper as she examined Mrs. Borriello's dark brown scarf that blended with her dark brown hair, her drawn face, her quick hands passing over one grapefruit and then another until she found one she liked. Mary leaned slightly toward the boy, wanting to hug him. "When?" "Almost a year." "1 year in October," Mrs. Borriello added, also looking at her son. All 3 were quiet as the shoppers rushed around them, and the produce man kept glancing at them and at their pockets to make sure they hadn't stuffed them without paying. "Hey," the boy said. "I remember the fireworks that time, remember?" "I do," Mary said, taking him by the shoulders and pulling him toward her. "I am lucky," she thought. "When I think I'm unlucky, I must remember that I am lucky. I'm blessed." The boy let himself be hugged and then politely pulled away. The woman said something in Italian, and the boy tried to signal his mother with his eyes that he didn't want to translate. "She says you have also had sadness," he said finally. "But your sadness is a blessing in disguise, maybe? maybe not, but maybe. That man was not a good one, and our Lord works in mysterious ways. The boy added on his own. He comes in sometimes. He seems different now. You might be right, Mary said, placing her hand on the woman's arm again to say goodbye. She began to turn away, to wish them a good day and best of luck, when a thought came to her mind. Carmine, she said. The boy waited. Does your mother have a boarder?
A boarder?
Someone who lives with you and pays a little of the rent?
No.
He looked at his mother, who was scrutinizing Mary. Mary got the feeling that she understood everything. She wanted to ask how they were making ends meet, but she knew that would be intruding too far. How to put it? She turned to Mrs. Borriello and spoke to her directly. Mrs. Borriello waited, and Mary felt she was already preparing a phrase to turn Mary down. I have a regular job, 6.5 days a week, and I earn decent wages, though not as good as I did before. Before the island, you understand? When I was a cook. This job is in a laundry, but the pay is regular. I could live with you, Mrs. Borriello, and help out with the rent and around the rooms. I'm neat, and the boys already know me. I would... Mrs. Borriello let go a stream of Italian, and the boy protested in Italian for a few sentences before turning and walking down the block a little, leaving the women alone. I've been thinking about something like this, the woman said. I don't like the idea of a stranger. I don't like to put it in a newspaper.
But I'm not a stranger. You saw me come and go for many years.
Yes, she stared at Mary, and Mary recalled the portrait of the Sacred Heart she'd noted that time she stood in the Borriello's dim kitchen after the older boy's death, Mrs. Borriello not yet able to get out of bed. This was a religious woman, and Mary was sure she'd disapproved of Alfred and their arrangement. What woman would approve? She'd been crazy and foolish. But what woman would have given up on him, knowing what he was like at his best? He was worth it, she wanted to say to Mrs. Borriello, and she loved him. And Christian doctrine preached forgiveness as much as it preached anything else. Underneath that scarf and those widow's weeds was a young woman, perhaps younger than Mary.
You understand, Mary wanted to say to her. I know you understand.
No guests, Mrs. Borriello said. Mary's face burned. It was no matter, Mary thought. A few weeks of living together, and the other woman would see that Mary wasn't like that. It had just been Alfred she'd made an exception for. Only Alfred. And now, Alfred was off and married and raising another man's son.
Never, Mary agreed.
She shook her head emphatically from side to side so the woman would understand. She felt a flush of sweat spring up on her neck. The boy was kicking a dried horse turd along the curb and glancing over at them. My boys stay in their bedroom. You get the cot in my room or the kitchen.
Yes, fine.
Mrs. Borriello named her price. It was more than at Mrs. Post's, and it meant Mary would save nothing. Not a single dime, unless she ate less, or washed her hair less often, or walked everywhere she went, or picked up another job for Sunday afternoons.
If I offer less, Mary considered, she will take it.
She said herself she doesn't want to advertise.
Yes, Mary said instead. I can do that.
Mrs. Borriello seemed surprised for a moment, and then happy. She waved over the boy. Mary shook the other woman's hand, and then the boy's. Each paid for her fruit, and they made their separate ways until the following Sunday, when Mary would move in. She had not given a single thought to the others in the building when she made the suggestion to Mrs. Borriello, but when she walked away and realized what had just been arranged, it felt again like time was moving backward, and that no matter how hard she tried to keep her eyes pointed to the step ahead, she kept getting knocked off balance, turned around. She gathered her belongings from Mrs. Post's when most of the others were out. It was only natural to feel that she was going home. Only when she saw the number hanging over the door, the dark entryway, the worn staircase beyond, did she truly understand what she'd done. At the bottom of the stairs was the same faded mural of a man on a horse, children picking fruit from trees. The plaster molding that had long ago been painted to match the wood of the banister had been chipped away further and sat along the baseboard in small piles of dust. After so many months of avoiding the place, of swinging wide so as not to run into anyone, there she was, the prodigal daughter, without a thing to show for herself except for a scorch burn on her wrist and swollen ankles and a set of 10 raw knuckles. They would laugh at her. She imagined Patricia Tiernan standing smug in her kitchen, saying what she always thought, what she always knew, while her fawning family gazed at her and nodded. She thought of the others who had never liked her, had never liked Alfred, and then how she and Alfred had thumbed their noses at what the others liked and didn't like. But now she was back, alone, and for the few seconds it took her to cross the landing, she thought about returning to Mrs. Post's, or to a boarding house, or asking if she could stay at the laundry for a week until she could find better accommodations. Everything about the place was familiar. The sag in the center of each stair, the smell of damp rising from the basement. If she were still cooking, she could have afforded their sixth-floor rooms on her own. Who lived there now? She thought of her old bed, her table, her sink, the spices she kept in the press. She began to climb the stairs. When she got to Mrs. Borriello's and knocked, the door opened immediately, and Mrs. Borriello took her bag and placed it under the cot, which was set up with pillows against the wall during the day to look like a small sofa. She nodded at Mary to sit. As soon as Mary pulled in her chair, Mrs. Borriello served her coffee with sweet condensed milk and fresh bread with salted butter. At the center of the table, she placed a bowl of fat, ripe blackberries. Mrs. Borriello sat across from her boarder, and the two women ate and sipped and enjoyed the silence. It was the most delicious meal Mary had tasted since before North Brother. "I want to thank you," Mary began, but discovered a blockage in her throat that the words couldn't skirt by. There was nothing to cry about, but the pressure behind her eyes was too much, and Mrs. Borriello was beside her, rubbing her back, saying that she must be tired. Why not a short nap before the boys come? Mary agreed that she'd like to lie down for a few minutes, not sleep, but just lie down, close her eyes, pray to God that things would get better for her here and not worse. "Oh, first I want to give you this," Mary said. "Yesterday was the first of the month, so it works out nicely." She opened her bag and removed from her wallet the price they'd agreed on, but the other woman just looked at it on the table, at the bills Mary had fanned out, at the coins piled on top. "Is it okay?" Mary asked. There was nothing else in her wallet if she owed more, if she'd misunderstood. She'd bought new wool tights that week, and twice in 10 days after closing the laundry with Lee, she'd gone to the little counter that sold hamburger steaks until midnight. She knew she shouldn't have done that. Once, fine, but twice? And couldn't the old tights have been mended? Then Mrs. Borriello dipped her head and covered her face with her hands. "Yes, it's okay," she said after a moment. When she composed herself, she told Mary that she was going to her room to lie down, too. Mary knew that avoiding her old friends now would make everything worse. It would be better to seek them out immediately, try to explain to them what had happened, let them see her face. Her silence from North Brother would be easier for them to understand than why she hadn't sought them out since her release. Joan was no obstacle. She'd already forgiven Mary by the time she'd flagged her down on the sidewalk. Little Dorothy Alice cried in the mornings, and over the sound of her wailing came Joan's soothing voice, singing about doggies or sleigh rides or the kingdom of heaven. Later, walking to work, Mary found herself humming along. There was Patricia Tiernan, who'd never liked Mary. Ever since Mary came back, Patricia seemed shocked to see her making her way up the stairs. "Oh, hi, Mary," Jimmy Tiernan said to her as they passed one evening, and just like in the old days, Patricia appeared on the landing above them and looked as if she would choke him with her mind if she had the power. As for Fran, the first time Mary saw her after returning to the building, her old friend was cool. She returned Mary's greeting and then continued up the stairs while Mary looked after her, feeling like she'd been slapped. After a few days, Mary worked up the courage to knock on her door. "Please, Fran, can't I come in?" It might have been the please that melted the frost. Fran opened the door and Mary took her usual chair, while Fran hunted for something sweet for them to eat. "Why didn't you come see us, Mary? I was sick when they sent you back to North Brother after the hearing. We had no idea you were released, and then Joan said she ran into you on the street. You could have stayed here. Why didn't you just ask? You didn't have to go to a boarding house. You didn't have to go up there and pay Mrs. Borriello for a corner of her kitchen. I don't even understand what happened." "I don't know," Mary said, and it was true. Now that she was sitting there, looking at her old friend, she couldn't remember why she let it go so long. "Why didn't you come to my hearing if you were following the case? Alfred was there, and I didn't hear from you after either." She could see on Fran's face that it had never occurred to her, and Mary never expected Fran to give up an entire day sitting in a stuffy courtroom. But it was the only way to get past these small hurts, to answer with another hurt. "You've been injured? Well, so have I." "I didn't know I could have gone to the hearing. I thought it was just lawyers and reporters. And you know I'm not a good writer. Sure, Robert said he'd take down a letter for me, but you know how that goes. You could have written to me more often, too." "You're right, Fran. I don't know why I said that. I'm sorry, it's just that Alfred..." Fran leaned forward. "I knew it was Alfred. You didn't want to run into him here." Fran asked her if she'd seen him in the week since she moved back. "No," Mary said. "Have you?" "Joan said he does odd jobs for Driscoll." "I haven't seen him either. Sometimes he's here a lot in a given week, and then not for a few weeks. And I think he tries his best to avoid me and Joan." Though Mary had instructed herself not to care, to try to forget about him, it was Alfred she had in her mind whenever she pushed out the building's front door and remembered her posture, when she put a protective hand to her hair. She braced herself to see him, and then, when a few days went by and she didn't see him, she realized she was disappointed. "So, tell me everything," Fran said. "Start from the beginning." As their coffee went cold, Mary described Dr. Soper, what he said about her, the day they captured her, the Willard Parker Hospital, North Brother, John Kane, the nurses and their collection canisters, Mr. O'Neill, the disappointment of the hearing and then finding out about Liza Meany, the boy, how disorienting it was to be back in New York City without being a cook, how she feared she'd never get used to it. When she finally stopped talking, Fran was quiet for a minute and then announced that she'd like to punch that Dr. Soper in the face, and Mary laughed. Never before had she thought about Soper and laughed, and it felt, for the first time, like that terrible part of her life was truly behind her. The two women talked until the clock struck midnight, and when she left, Mary knew they'd be fine. Liberty. 16. Living with Liza seemed perfect at first. It had been years since Alfred felt what it was like to be sober and sound on his own two feet, his lungs full of air, his spine straight, his body strong. When he came home, Liza didn't seem the least bit surprised that he'd worked all day. She didn't make a fuss over it like Mary used to, and with Liza he could sense no panic that he would change his mind, that the next day would see him having slipped down to the place of a man who didn't work. He was healthy and capable, and Liza didn't watch him like Mary did. She didn't narrow her eyes and know things the way Mary knew them, sometimes before he knew himself. When he brought her his wages, she looked at him like he'd handed her a block of solid gold and she needed those dollars and cents. The boy ate as much as Alfred and Liza combined, and he was smart. He needed books, scratch pads, decent clothing, shoes. But after almost 10 months of the arrangement, Alfred faced what he knew all along, that Liza Meany was not Mary Mallon and never would be. When they made love, she was dutiful and kind. She never made up an excuse or pretended to be asleep or told him to go fly a kite, and she looked politely away when he removed the nightcap from its tin. If she'd ever seen one before, she didn't mention it, nor could he tell if she liked or disliked what they were doing. One time, to test her, he stopped abruptly, pulled away, tugged on his trousers, and told her they could do it later, since she wasn't feeling up to it. And she said that was fine, as if he'd suggested they walk north along Broadway instead of south. "Oh, well, you don't seem fine. You seem distracted," he said, and she didn't argue. She just pulled her dress back over her shoulders and went about fastening the row of buttons. Another time, he kept pushing and nuzzling and reaching under her clothes to see when she would stop him, but she never stopped him, even though he knew she was tired and wanted nothing more than to sleep. He kept testing and testing, and next thing he knew, he was inside her with Samuel doing his homework in the next room. And only once, one single instant, when the bed creaked, did she push him away and look to the door in case Samuel might have heard. This is how most women are, he told himself. This is how women should be. Only he'd never known what a woman should be like, because he'd mostly ever been with Mary, who was not a normal woman. Even the newspapers noticed it. Back when she was first captured, most of the newsmen commented that she had the bearing of an Irish person, but one reporter observed that she in fact had the bearing of a man. Irish or not, he didn't specify. It was true. Sometimes she stood with her legs planted wide, especially when she felt herself backed into a corner. But nothing about Mary was manly to the eye, and so it must have been something else that this man had seen. A way of conducting herself, a way of glancing around a room. Fran Mosley, who saved the papers for him back then, had said she didn't understand that one at all, because who, in their right mind, seeing Mary's thick mane of strawberry blonde hair and slim waist, would see anything other than a woman? Alfred had said, "I know what he means, I think." And Fran had looked at him like he was the bastard she'd always suspected him to be. Mary didn't need the money he brought in because she had her own money, more money than he earned. He knew exactly how she felt about everything, because she told him, usually very loudly, often while banging pots and pans for emphasis. When she didn't want him to touch her, she told him to get lost. But when she didn't mind reaching for him first, coming around to his side, kissing the back of his neck and asking if he was too tired. Liza Meany would never do that. Not in 1,000 years. At first, he thought how wonderful that was, how ladylike. Liza was like a delicate bird, and how much more interesting that made everything when she let him unbutton her, and how fiercely she blushed when he lifted her to sit on top of him or whispered to her to turn around. She looked disoriented and terrified whenever he moved her to a different position, and after just a few seconds, she always dove back down to the covers and to her back, where she felt comfortable and safe. And he'd laugh. "Okay, okay," he'd say. And he could see how much he'd have to show her, if she was willing to be shown. But after 10 months, he could see she didn't want that. Sex for Liza Meany would always be part of the transaction they'd agreed upon, and although she liked him and was attracted to him, Alfred felt sure he'd be able to tell if she wasn't. She saw sex with him the same way she saw making his breakfast, washing his clothes, having supper on the table when he got home. They'd been engaged for 6 months, but still weren't married. She showed her ring to all their neighbors, a simple silver band, and maybe that's all she'd wanted, for the world to know that she was not the kind of woman who lived with a man without a promise. At first, she said she wanted to figure a way to bring her mother from England for the ceremony. And sometimes she said she wanted to wait until the school year was over, so Samuel wouldn't be distracted. Distracted? Alfred wanted to ask. What would be so distracting? Or, for that matter, what was there to cross an ocean for? Alfred had imagined himself and Liza walking to City Hall, signing a few papers, and then going to a restaurant for supper. But he didn't say anything, and when the weeks wore on without any letters arriving from England, without any discussion of whether they'd have a small party, he stopped worrying about it. Maybe accepting the engagement without pushing actual marriage was the small way she was asserting herself. That, and making him continue with the cure, even though he felt he didn't need it anymore. The medicine they gave in the beginning made him sick, and he assumed that was part of it, making the patient so sick that he wouldn't be able to hold alcohol or anything else. He was weak for 2 weeks, curled up in bed and vomiting into the bowl Liza gave him. And still, she came in every 4 hours with another dose she'd measured out into a teacup, just as the doctor had instructed. "It's for people far worse than I am," he'd told her when he first came back from Bellevue, where he'd gone to see what it was all about. Ads for the cure were posted all around the neighborhood and published in big block letters in the newspapers. "I saw them. Jesus, I saw them. I'm not like that. My God, one man? He wasn't much more than a boy. He was sweating a puddle on the floor but kept complaining of cold. I just like to have a nip now and again, and if you go out and find a man who never has a nip now and then, I'll saw off my right arm." "You'll go if you want to live here," she told him simply. So he went back, and back. And soon they sent him home with directions on how to dole out the medicine and at what intervals. After a month, they said he could stop taking the medicine, but to keep a supply in his old pocket flask. That he'd never had need for that flask proved he never needed the cure in the first place. It was just a matter of deciding. And he'd decided. It was a 100% guarantee as long as he followed the doctor's instructions. And the doctor's instructions were, don't drink. Samuel was preparing for a test that would allow him to skip 2 grades ahead at school and take a few courses at the community college. If he scored high enough, he would go for free, except for the cost of books. They had to be very, very quiet around the flat so as not to interrupt the boy's studies, and for the first time since he'd known her, Liza shushed him one morning when he began to ask if there was any more coffee on the stove. She shushed Alfred and cast a worried look at Samuel, who had his head bent over a mathematics book, and Alfred saw then that she'd never love him, never love any man, as much as she loved that boy. The ice company's stable did not offer overtime, and the evenings were too long between 5 o'clock, when his shift ended, and 10 o'clock, when he went to bed. To get out of their rooms and give the boy some quiet, Alfred had started checking in with Michael Driscoll. The old man needed boards replaced on the floor, a cabinet fixed, his rotted bed carried out to the sidewalk and replaced with a new one, the plaster on the wall behind the sink touched and smoothed. A little late for this kind of attention, Alfred had teased the first time he went over.
Never too late, Driscoll had said. I've my eye on a fine woman.
You're joking.
You'll get there, then you'll know, and someone else will laugh.
Fair enough, Alfred supposed, and went on with the work he was assigned. When he finished a job, he'd let a few weeks go by, and then he'd check in on the old man to see what he'd stored up for him. In the stretches when Driscoll had no work for him, he hung around the stable after his shift to talk to the man who relieved him, or he walked down to the docks to watch what was being unloaded. One evening, though he didn't know Alfred would be stopping around, Driscoll answered the door as soon as Alfred knocked.
"Well, did you see her?"
the old man asked and looked over Alfred's shoulder toward the empty stairwell. He coughed into his sleeve and then rolled it up.
"Who?" Alfred asked. "Mary, she's out there. I was talking with her not 1 minute ago."
"Mary Mallon is in this building?"
"She moved in with Mrs. Borriello a week ago."
"You didn't know?" Alfred felt a tremor travel down his arms and legs, and he thought he heard a woman's step pass in the hall. He looked hard at Driscoll's face to make sure the old man wasn't having him on. He'd sent a letter to her hut on North Brother a few months earlier, and when she didn't write back, he figured she was still that angry with him, and had a right to be. She'd said the lawyer was optimistic. She'd said it might only be a few more months. But why would he have believed it?
"Are you serious, Driscoll?"
"I swear on my life."
"How? When was she released? Was she looking for me? What did you talk about?"
"She was just passing through the vestibule as I was searching for my key. I said hello, and so did she, so then I said I was glad to see her back, and she thanked me. She might still be climbing the stairs. Go on, go after her."
Instead, Alfred pushed past him and looked at the weeping faucet that needed to be fixed. As he took inventory of what he'd need, he felt the other man's eyes sizing up the shape of his back, his stance, trying to read what was written there. He needed time to think. He had no idea what he'd say. Every part of his body urged him toward the door. Why was she staying with Mrs. Borriello? What was she doing now? He imagined what he'd say to her, and when he realized he couldn't think of a place to begin, he imagined instead what she'd say to him, and knew that the first thing she'd ask was whether he was married yet to Liza Meany, and after he said that he wasn't, she'd ask if he was still living with her and her boy, and he'd have to say yes, and then the meeting would be over.
"I can't come around tomorrow," Alfred said gruffly to Driscoll once the faucet was fixed. "I'll do the rest another time."
"You'll have to face her sooner or later," Driscoll said, and Alfred had a wild impulse to shove him, to throttle him, but it passed immediately.
It was himself he was angry at, no one else.
"Why do I have to?" he said, though he wanted to do more than face her. He wanted to run upstairs right that second to see her, beg her forgiveness, take her into his arms. How had it happened? How had he missed it? How could he have failed to know she was back in the city?
Alfred stayed away from 302 East 33rd Street as he tried to make sense of Mary's return. In the mornings, when he woke to Liza's blonde curls on the pillow next to him, he thought immediately of Mary, sleeping so close to the rooms they'd shared for so many years, seemingly back in her old life, except without him. "Everything all right at the stable?" Liza asked several times, and he snapped at her that it was, and tried to stay out of their rooms even more than usual. Another time, she asked him if he carried his medicine with him when he went out, and he realized she thought he'd fallen off the wagon. It was true. He'd gone and stood outside Nation's pub for the first time in months, but he hadn't gone in. And the pull he felt from 302 East 33rd was much stronger. Finally, after 2 weeks of turning round and round the news of Mary's return, he finished his work at the stable and made for Driscoll's place, to finish up the work that was there waiting for him, and to decide one way or another if he would ever go near the place again. As he walked up Third Avenue, he felt the possibility of seeing her again like a singing bird lodged in his chest, struggling to free itself. He stopped at the peanut cart on 29th Street to get a bag for himself and Driscoll to share, but even this was a show for her, in case she was watching. In case he should turn around and she should be standing there, half-smiling, ready to say, "Well, well, well, look who it is." It was the first truly bitter evening of the season, and there was no one on the stoop or in the vestibule when Alfred arrived at the building. He stood at the bottom of the silent stairwell and looked up, counting the railings to the fourth floor. When Driscoll didn't answer his knock, Alfred felt along the top of the door frame for the key that was hidden there and let himself in. "Hello?" he called, and when he got no answer, he opened the door to Driscoll's bedroom and found him lying there, twisted up in the sheets. "Not feeling myself," Driscoll said, without looking at Alfred. And as Alfred got closer to the bed, he could see that the older man was wincing and trying to find relief from whatever was bothering him by shifting from side to side, clutching at his pillow. He coughed for several minutes. For the first time in 2 weeks, Alfred pushed thoughts of Mary to the side. "What is it?" Alfred asked, to the back of the man's head, and noticed how thin Driscoll's hair was there, how small and delicate seeming the back of his skull was, like a smooth, hairless egg. "Go on," said Driscoll, "another time." But Alfred stood there like a boy, unsure what to do. "I'm just feeling poorly. Come around in a few days." "Can I bring you something? Have you eaten?" But Driscoll only moved closer to the wall. "I'll check on you tomorrow," he said. And when Driscoll didn't respond, Alfred left. He stood at the bottom of the stairwell for a minute, tempted to go up to see Mary, but he'd be back the next day, and between now and then, maybe he'd think of the perfect thing to say. Alfred arrived home in time for a nearly silent supper with Liza and Samuel. In the morning, he decided he couldn't go another day without seeing Mary, and once he'd decided, he had no patience for being at the stable, alone with the horses. Now that the weather was cold, the demand for ice was way down, as was the supply until the winter harvest. The trucks went out every day, but mostly to businesses. A few blocks here and there, to the rich houses that didn't care to keep their milk and butter on the window ledge like Mary had always done, and Liza did now, but preferred to serve ice in glasses to their guests, even in the winter months. Lately, Alfred had felt that pinch that told him he would not last there for much longer. He would have to find something else. 10 blocks north was a stable the ice company rented to the Department of Health, and that was more interesting. On quiet afternoons, Alfred walked up there with the ready excuse that he was still concerning himself with company property. When he first started at the stable, he didn't understand why the Department of Health needed so many horses. Whenever a horse got too old to haul an ice truck or was too difficult to drive through the city, the minute his stable always said that the Department of Health would take it. And now Alfred said it too, but he didn't know why until one day, a bright autumn afternoon, he walked the 10 blocks to distract himself, and when he got to the stable, he saw that the large side room that used to be a dairy, back when the city had cows, had been turned into a slaughterhouse for horses. There were 2 horses up on slings with gashes in their necks, and a glass instrument stuck in each bloody wound. Below the horses' mighty bellies were lined up rows and rows of buckets where blood had been collected, and all around were men in white lab coats. "Out!" one yelled when he saw Alfred. The man was crouching beside the larger of the 2 horses, checking the glass tube, and when he scrambled up to shoo away Alfred, he slipped on a small spot of blood on the floor, knocking over a full bucket as he tried to right himself. The other men cursed and glared at Alfred. The horses, who were still alive, each turned a wild, terrified eye to Alfred and seemed to understand that he was the only one in the room who might help them. "Jesus Christ!" Alfred said when he got back out to the glare of the street, the flies in front of the stable door frantic with the smell of blood. He passed through the other door to the stable proper, where there were 12 horses munching on hay as if they were out at pasture. "What are they doing?" Alfred asked the boy who was sitting on an upturned bucket in the corner, reading an old newspaper. Bleeding, the boy said, and simply turned the page. Later, when he and Samuel were elbow to elbow at the table, waiting for Liza to spoon out their supper, it was Samuel who told him what he'd probably seen, that the horses were being bled for their serum, which would be used to make inoculations against disease. Diphtheria, probably, the boy said. I read about it. Or typhoid, maybe. They're working on something. Come on, horse blood? Horse serum? They inject the horse with the disease and wait for the horse to develop the means to fight it, and then they take out the blood and whittle it down to the fighting parts, and then they put that in an injection and give it to people. Didn't you ever wonder what's in the shots people get? The boy leaned back in his chair and regarded Alfred. Alfred was ashamed to say he had not ever wondered what was in an injection. Before seeing Dr. Oppenheimer, he'd never gotten an injection in his life, and now he wondered what the doctor was putting in him. There was witchcraft in the old country, but nothing this dark, as far as Alfred could remember. Certain herbs and weeds, a way of mixing. Poultices smeared on chests, aromatic flowers ground down to powders and stirred up into tea. But this horse blood business seemed like more sinister magic. Liza had turned from the stove to listen to her son, and now, understanding that her boy was finished explaining, she turned back to her saucepan of gravy, her cheeks spotted with pride and pleasure. Now, the day yawning before him until it was time to sign out and walk over to 33rd Street, he considered going up to the DOH stables to pass the time. Instead, he signed himself out for 5 o'clock, even though it was only 2. Driscoll was not better. Alfred opened the man's door slowly and knew immediately by the silence in the cold kitchen that he was still in bed. He found Driscoll in the same position, and when Alfred put his hand on the back of his neck, it felt like a furnace, and Driscoll moaned. "Should I get you something?" Alfred asked, feeling like a big, hulking, useless thing that was too stupid to know how to help. He went to the kitchen and ran a dishcloth under cold water. He brought it back to the bed, laid it across the old man's head, and then worried as he saw the sheets darken where the wet touched them. Driscoll shifted away. "You need help, I think," Alfred said, more to himself than to the old man. A doctor, but he'd never called on a doctor before. He could have knocked on Fran's door, or gone up to confer with Jimmy Tiernan, but he marched on past the second-floor landing, past the third. He needed Mary. The elderly sisters, who also lived on the fourth floor, had their door cracked for air, and Alfred knew he could stop and ask them. He'd seen Driscoll talk to them from time to time, and when one of them injured her knee, Driscoll had gone up there with a baked cod on a platter because they couldn't get out. But instead of stopping, Alfred kept going to the Borriello's door and drew a breath. If Mrs. Borriello answered, he'd have to speak up, speak slowly, and then everyone would hear, and his whole reason for going up there would be confused. Because he was really going up there for Driscoll, and if it ended up that he and Mary would start talking again because of it, fine, as long as Driscoll improved. The younger boy answered, and when he saw who it was, his eyes went wide. "Is Mary here?" The boy raised a finger to Alfred and then shut the door. Alfred heard movement inside, a chair pushed back along the wood floor. When the door opened again, it was Mrs. Borriello. The boy peeked at him from behind his mother. "Yes," she said. "I'm looking for Mary. I understand she's been staying here." "Why?" Alfred felt himself getting annoyed. "Mr. Driscoll isn't well, and I thought Mary would know what to do." "Sick?" Mrs. Borriello said. "Yes, since yesterday. Maybe longer. Is Mary here?" But Mrs. Borriello was already gathering her scarf. She said something to the boy before slipping past Alfred and down the stairs to Michael Driscoll's door. The boy regarded Alfred from the doorframe. "She doesn't get home until later."
"Yeah? Are you in charge of her schedule?"
"No. I'm in charge of the lamp. I bring it back to the kitchen when she gets home from the laundry, and we do our figures at the table while she's eating. My brother and me, I mean. Then when she's done, I take it back to my room. My mother says it's our lamp, not hers, but we have to let her borrow it to eat by because it's not right to ask a person to eat in the dark when there's a good lamp a room away."
"She works at a laundry? Where?"
"It's almost on Washington Square."
"Which side? What street?"
"Mr. Brayhoff!" Mrs. Borriello was calling for him from the bottom of the dark stairs. "Didn't you used to live upstairs?" the boy asked. Mrs. Borriello shouted again. "He needs firewood," the boy said. "Better go in and get some of ours. She wants me to go down to her." The boy ran down the stairs, shouting something to his mama all the way, and Alfred turned and put his hand on the Borriello's doorknob. He pushed the heavy door and listened as the bottom brushed the floor like all the doors did in 302, leaving little arcs of scratch marks as welcome mats to every room. The wood was stacked by the stove, twigs, parts of branches, bits and pieces they must have collected from around the city. Alfred went over and selected a few of the heftiest pieces. When he turned, he noticed the cot, and on the cot, two folded blouses. On the windowsill above the cot was a woman's comb, a collection of hairpins, hair powder, a tub of cream. He recognized the comb and the brand of cream. He left the wood on the Borriello's table and sat on the edge of Mary's bed. He didn't dare touch the blouses. It was bad enough he'd mussed the bed, but he studied the collars for signs of her skin, some detail that might have been caught in the material. He sniffed them, then leaned over, his head between his knees to peer under the cot, searching for some lost thing she might have given up on and which he could keep. But there was nothing except dust. He thought about leaving her a note, the long overdue letter she'd wanted so badly when she was on North Brother, the empty tin of tobacco from his pocket that she would know was his, knowing his brand and knowing they would tell her the story later, how he'd come knocking and how he'd spent a few minutes in the flat alone. He heard the boy's light step on the stairs, two at a time, so he went to smooth the quilt, but then decided, no, he'd leave it the way it was. Let her imagine him sitting there, thinking about her. He gathered the wood, and by the time he had it in his arms, the boy was there with his brother, to tell him that their mother had banned them, had sent them upstairs with instructions to close their door and not to come down again. And, if she wasn't home by supper, they were to be good boys and boil themselves an egg and clean up after and go straight to bed. There was something in the building, and she didn't want them around until they figured out what it was. Driscoll was worse. His fever was high, and he complained of pain in his back. When he coughed into his pillow, he left behind spots of blood. He couldn't hold the teacup Mrs. Borriello had filled with broth, so she sat on the edge of his bed and lifted it to his mouth. "Slow," she said. "Little sips." At moments, he seemed to feel better, but then he was again moaning and clutching at the bed as if it were just a matter of getting deeper, of burrowing himself away from his rooms into a cooler place underneath it all, where he might find some relief. "Should I run out to get medicine? A doctor? He has a little money, you know." Mrs. Borriello peered at Alfred. She seemed to want to make herself into a wall between the two men. "I mean for the doctor. I think he could pay a doctor, and I think a doctor has to see a sick person anyway, even if he can't pay."
"I think that's true. Because I've never seen something like this, have you?"
"Yes. The blood on the pillow? The coughing with fever? I saw it one time."
"Okay, then, I'll go."
"Where?"
"I don't know. I'll go up and ask Fran. She had the doctor come once, for one of the children."
He wanted to ask where Mary was, what time she'd be home. They heard the scrape of the door being slowly pushed open.
"Mama?"
came a boy's voice. Mrs. Borriello was across the room in an instant, pushing her youngest son into the hall and trying to shut the door on him. She shouted at him in Italian, but still he tried to insert the toe of his boot in the door. As they struggled, Alfred stepped out into the hall and lifted the boy under the arms.
"Go, go, go!" Mrs. Borriello shouted at both of them, and then added something in Italian.
"I'm staying with my mama,"
the boy cried as Alfred carried him to the stairs.
"You have to go up," Alfred said.
Mrs. Borriello shouted again.
"She says tell everybody don't come down here. Bad enough there's two of us already, three of us including me. She says she'll kill me later. To you, she says stand back from the door when you talk to Miss Fran about the doctor. Want me to do it? She says we could be breathing it now, whatever it is."
As Alfred climbed the steps with one hand bracing the boy by the upper arm, he thought of Liza and how she'd worry, but there was nothing he could do, and really it would be the wrong idea to go home to her now and carry this thing to her, to Samuel. She'd understand that he had to stay in 302 until he saw this thing through. And if Mary arrived home later and the boys told her everything, how Alfred had searched for her, how he'd stayed on to help their mama, how he'd rushed down the stairs with their wood and kindling to help Mr. Driscoll. And if hearing about all that made her want to see him again, to talk only, and if talking softened her toward him enough so that she didn't object when he touched her, then he couldn't help that, either.
17. The one Dr. Fran knew of had moved uptown, but Mr. Stern, from the third floor, knew of a good man who made house calls. Jimmy Tiernan was elected to go to West 16th to fetch him, and as he rushed down the stairs and out onto the dark sidewalk, Patricia looked after him, relieved that her man was traveling farther away from whatever poison was dwelling at Mr. Driscoll's. First thing in the morning, she was going to bring their children to her sister's in New Jersey and stay there until this thing passed. Jimmy Tiernan didn't return until nearly 8 o'clock in the evening. He shouted through Driscoll's closed door that the doctor would be there shortly. Alfred and Mrs. Borriello took turns sitting with Driscoll. A few times, Alfred tried to raise the subject of Mary. When it was Mrs. Borriello's turn to sit with Driscoll, Alfred sat in the chair in the corner of Driscoll's bedroom. "Your son said Mary works at a laundry now." Mrs. Borriello glanced over at him quickly and simply nodded. "Does she like it? She was a laundress before, you know, when I met her." When Mrs. Borriello showed no indication that she'd even heard him speak, he knew that there was no point in trying. When it was his turn to sit with Driscoll, he patted the old man's head with the compress and realized he'd never before been around anyone as ill. At 9 o'clock came a strong knock on the door and an unfamiliar man's voice announcing himself as Dr. Hoffman. Relieved, Alfred jumped up to open the door. Dr. Hoffman asked about Driscoll's first symptoms, how long he'd been in the state he was in, what his health was before he came down ill. He pulled the older man up to sitting, and Driscoll fell toward the doctor's lap like a sleeping child lifted from his crib by his mama. The doctor listened to Driscoll's chest, took his pulse, and then told Alfred to go straight to the nearest grocer and ask them to call for an ambulance. As Alfred rushed down the hall, he heard a voice behind him. "How is he?" Mary asked. She was standing 2 steps above the second floor landing. She was wearing a dark green dress that buttoned in a double-breasted style up to her throat. She was as familiar to him as his own reflection in the mirror, and he saw clearly how silly he'd been, play-acting with another woman, a woman he barely knew, and who barely knew him, when his life was here, standing on the landing above him. "I'm to get an ambulance."
"Well, go."
Alfred ran. He pumped his arms and lifted his knees and dodged pedestrians who stepped before him. The faster he ran, the younger he felt, and though his errand was serious, he felt buoyant. Mary was back. She would forgive him. They would make up, and he would leave Liza. He and Mary would find new rooms together. He'd get good work. He leaped over a pile of horse manure. He nodded to the wandering sausage man, who watched him pass with amazement on his face. How could he refuse marriage to her now when he had asked Liza Meany? Maybe Mary wouldn't want to marry him now. Maybe she had no interest. It didn't matter. None of it mattered. Not so long as they lived together again and came home to each other every night. When he returned to Driscoll's rooms, Mary had taken over Mrs. Borriello's spot by the bed and was talking to the doctor. Mrs. Borriello sat at the table with her head in her hands. "What is it?" Alfred asked from the frame of Driscoll's bedroom door. "Looks like hasty consumption," Mary said without turning. "They'll take him to a sanatorium," the doctor said. "Each of you should watch yourself for symptoms, and at the first sign, you should segregate yourself." It was nearly midnight when the ambulance took Michael Driscoll, and once the neighbors retreated from their perches on the landings where they'd watched the spectacle, Mary remembered what the nurses used to do at Riverside after tending to a patient, and instructed Alfred and Mrs. Borriello to wash their hands. Mary knew Alfred was looking at her as he leaned against the wall that divided the kitchen from the bedroom. She hardened her belly and kept her eyes from meeting his. She spoke to him as if he were anyone, someone she'd just met, not the man she'd loved since she was 17 years old. "When you get home, you should wash yourself well, boil your clothes, or throw them away." Now that Driscoll was at the hospital, there would be no need for Alfred to come around anymore, and if he stopped coming, then this, an interval of several hours, wouldn't mean anything, and she could go back to pretending he didn't exist. She heard him draw his breath as if to speak, but then release it again. Mrs. Borriello took Mary by the hand. "Hold on," Alfred said, taking 2 quick steps toward the door as if to block it. "Mary," he said softly.
can I come up to talk a minute, or can we take a walk?
It's the middle of the night, said Mrs. Borriello.
She can speak for herself.
Why? Mary asked. I have to talk to you, Mary.
Another time, maybe, Mary said, and Mrs. Borriello followed her boarder out the door. Upstairs, the boys asleep, Mary found Mrs. Borriello's largest pot and filled it with water. She filled the kettle, too. Once the water was boiled, the women took off their dresses and their underclothes and shoved them to a corner of the kitchen. Mrs. Borriello stepped into the bath first while Mary dropped their underwhites into Mrs. Borriello's pot and stirred them like she was checking on a stew. Then Mary bathed while Mrs. Borriello stirred. The water, at such a rapid boil, the pot hopped on the stove. When they were both dressed in fresh clothing, their damp hair loose around their shoulders, their undergarments drying over the sink, Mary made coffee and poured it into two cups. Mrs. Borriello yawned. The kitchen was warm and comfortable, and Mary's body felt clean and soft under the fresh clothes. Mrs. Borriello stretched her arms over her head and purred.
"What's your first name?" Mary asked.
"Amelia. My family called me Mila."
"Pretty?"
"Not many call me Mila now."
"No."
The clock on the mantel ticked its rhythm, and Mary remembered Aunt Kate, how they'd sit in the silent kitchen until late, Kate sewing, Mary sipping tea and reading aloud from the newspaper, until it came time to go to sleep. Mila Borriello began smoothing her fine black hair, first one side and then the other. She pulled it away from her face and twisted it behind her head. In only her camisole, and with her cheeks still rosy from the steam of the bath and the warmth of the room, Mary could see that she was still a beautiful woman.
"How old are you?"
"I am 34 years old," Mila smiled.
"You thought older?"
Mary nodded. The two women regarded each other in silence.
"I was married before," Mila said. "Before Salvatore."
"I didn't know that."
"Of course not. How would you know?"
Mary waited.
"His name was Alberto. Is Alberto. He's still alive someplace. I don't know. Last I saw him was in Naples."
Mary felt the room seem to settle down around them. Her hand rested on the table not 6 inches away from Mila's hand. She'd never invited her, Mary considered now. She'd never asked her up for tea or coffee, or knocked on her door to see if she needed anything from the market. When Mary, Fran, and Joan made a plan to go put their feet in the fountain or walk in the park, they'd never asked if Mila Borriello felt like joining them. Alfred sometimes wondered why the Borriellos didn't live downtown on one of the Italian streets, but mostly they didn't think of the Borriellos at all.
"This Alberto, he was father to my oldest boy. You remember?"
"The drowned boy, also Alberto. They called him Albie." Albertos became Albies in America.
"I'm not sure I understand."
"He was not such a good man, Alberto. In some ways, yes, a decent man. He always made good wages, but in most ways, not such a good man. He loved me and loved his boy in his way, but he was not the way a man should be. He lifted his hand to me every day, and I knew he would lift his hand to my boy. Maybe he would wait until my boy got strong, but maybe not. At first, I thought I could spend a little less, sit a little less, but then I saw he would do it anyway, and I'm not a woman who deserves hitting. So, one day he beat me with the leg of a chair, and I left him. I took the boy while he was out of the house and stayed with a woman neighbor, and then I came to New York City and called myself a widow. Then I met Salvatore in America and told him all of it. Some men, they would leave a woman who told him a thing like that. Some men would side with the other man, even not knowing him, even the man all the way in Naples. Not Salvatore. He believed me and trusted me, and then we had our own two boys, Carmine and Anthony. He was kind to me every day of his life." Mila looked at Mary very seriously. "They don't know this, Carmine and Anthony. They think Alberto was their full brother, their father's son."
"I understand."
Mary remembered that horrible afternoon. "I'm so sorry about Salvatore. And about Albie. We never talked about—"
"It's fine.
Mila said, and set her mouth in that familiar way she had, a widow's pursed lips, worried brow. They were quiet for a long time. I don't think of that day too much, sending them out for wood. Much more I think of before we came here, and when it was just the two of us, that baby with me on the ship, and how careful I was to give him the cleanest portion of the sheet and the best of what we had at meals. You've never seen a baby cling the way Alberto clung to me in America when we got here first. Sometimes it's hard to understand that that baby turned into my boy, that that baby disappeared and turned into a boy, and then that boy disappeared. So he left me twice. Do you understand? Your English is very good. I don't mean my English. I mean, do you understand about having a baby and worrying sick over him and finally getting him away from a dangerous thing and then having so much good happen, and then the baby grows into a handsome boy and then he is gone?